From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The name of the band is The National Parks, so it makes sense you will find tons of images from nature in their music. There are forests that meet the plains and bending rivers that meet the sea. Forests, actually, in a number of songs, the rivers, too. Not to mention campfires and the moon and the sun and the stars. In fact, light seems important in their songs. Brady Parks of the band says they often find parallels between nature and life. It helps them express love and spirituality and that impulse to take a risk and go for it, which is what they've done with their latest album. Today in the program, the National Parks are joining us as we continue our local music series. They will be with us to play live after this news.
Hey, podcast listener. I'm Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West. If you like what you hear on the show, you can lend a hand by giving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Facebook. And we'd also really appreciate it if you'd share what you think about the show, or if you have some thoughts about a particular episode, share that stuff around on whatever social media platforms you happen to use. Thanks a bunch and enjoy the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When you hear about the life of Alexander von Humboldt, you're going to be surprised you don't really know anything about the man. And it wasn't always the case, by the way. Humboldt was incredibly popular and well-known in this country for decades, and there are complicated reasons why he's largely been forgotten. Humboldt was a polymath. He didn't stick to just one specialty. He studied pretty much everything he could get his hands on. In her new book on Humboldt's life and work, Andrea Wolf says that in a world where we tend to draw a sharp line between the sciences and the arts, between the subjective and the objective, Humboldt's insights about nature are seen as revolutionary because he crossed all those lines all throughout his life. Wolf calls Humboldt a founding father of environmentalists and ecologists and nature writers because he was one of the first to see that all life on this planet is connected. And Humboldt's insight, she says, was that we can only truly understand nature by using our imagination. Today in the program, Andrea Wolf is joining us to talk about her new book. It's called The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. She is joining us from the studios of the BBC in London. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, in The Guardian, The Wall Street Journal, among others. She's the author of a number of books, among them Founding Gardeners, The Brother Gardeners, Chasing Venus, and Andrea Wolf, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Early on in the book, you say this is your attempt, this book, The Invention of Nature, is your attempt to find Alexander von Humboldt. What do you mean by that? What do you mean, find him?
Well, I've done a few books about the relationship between humankind and nature, and Humboldt kind of popped up in quite a lot of them. And whenever I ask people about him, most of the time, the most common reaction was a blank face because very few people had heard of him. Now, I'm German, and I had heard of him in my school time, but no one in the English-speaking world seemed to really know much about him. So I thought I would like to find out more. And because he's so important. And what I discovered was this incredible story, and I decided that I would like the world to know about Humboldt again. So this is really my attempt to find him and to write his story, but also not just his story, but also the story of his legacy, because he influenced so many very important people like Charles Darwin or Jefferson or Bolivar. So it's the biography of him, but it's also a biography of the people he influenced.
We'll get into the details as we go, but you say the story gives meaning to why we see nature the way we see it today. What do you mean by that?
Well, he comes up with this idea, this concept of nature as a web of life, as you said in your introduction, as Earth, as a living organism where everything is connected. He really sees nature as a global force, which is something that very much colors our thinking of nature today, and which was very different to how scientists regarded nature before him, because they were very much looking at plants, for example, through the very narrow lens of classification. So they were looking, they were collecting plants and they were classifying them. They were kind of finding the taxonomic units where they sit in. And then there Humboldt comes along and says, like, no, this is not what we should be doing. This is right for botany, but we should look at plants on a global level. We should understand them in terms of where they grow, which altitude they grow, for example. So he comes up with this idea that there are vegetation zones slung across the globe, which is, you know, of course, very much what we understand today about nature.
Yeah. I mean, it's very self-evident, all those ideas now, but how revolutionary, how maybe controversial were they for their time?
They were very revolutionary. They were not. Once he wrote a lot of books and he convinced a lot of people that this was the way to see it. So it wasn't actually controversial that much. It was just very revolutionary. Right. And he spends his entire life trying to explain nature as this web of life. And he lives a very long life. He dies just before his 90th birthday. And he writes so many books that he himself loses track how many he has published.
Right.
So he also believes, and I think that's what makes him so special, he also believes that knowledge should be exchanged and available for everybody, not just for the scientists who sit in their ivory tower. So he publishes these books. Some of them are very scientific and are for a specialized audience, but he publishes a lot of books which are very much written for the general audience, in which he describes nature without difficult scientific terms. And he starts writing about nature unlike any other scientist. He describes nature sometimes more like a poet. So he has these beautiful, evocative, poetic landscape descriptions in his scientific books. And with that, almost provides a blueprint to all of nature writing today, whereby he combines these evocative landscape descriptions with scientific observations.
It seems like, and we'll come back to this idea a little bit later in the program, but it seems like people concerned with climate change, for example, the challenge of climate change, concerned about extinction, concerned about all in any number of environmental challenges that are facing the planet today, could maybe take a page out of Humboldt in the sense that he could, as you said, he could be accessible. He was a great communicator. I think almost more important than anything else, Humboldt had a sense of the poetic, and that seems like to me the thing that people really responded to was that sense of the senses and the emotions and imagination. That may have been one of the keys to why people loved him so much.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. He truly incites a love for nature, which I think is so lacking sometimes today. He begins his life very much as a scientist of the Enlightenment, believing in reason and rational thought and measurements. And then when he's in his mid-20s, he changes and he begins to believe that we have to use our imagination and our feelings, our emotions to truly understand nature. Mm-hmm. And with that, he almost bridges the Enlightenment and Romanticism, but he believes that you cannot understand nature by just sitting in your study. So he says scientists need to leave their garrets. They need to go out. They need to travel the world. They need to see nature and all its beauty and grandeur. And he brings those descriptions back to his readers and really wants people to go out to enjoy it. And he understands, because he is out in nature, he understands the ecosystem of nature much better, although he never calls it an ecosystem, but right. That's very much how he understands it.
I wonder, maybe that's why you felt like you had to go to these places rather than just read about them. You took his advice.
Well, put it this way, it was a very good excuse to go on some very, very nice trips. Well, I'm a writer. All my books are about nature, And the reason for that is because I love being in nature. But I also believe that I can't describe his voyages, for example. He spends 5 years in Latin America. I can't describe his voyages just by reading his diaries. I needed to see these landscapes he had seen. So I went, for example, to Ecuador to climb some of the volcanoes he had climbed. I went to Venezuela and paddled along the Orinoco to, you know, deep in the rainforest to get an understanding of what he had seen. So for me, it was as important as reading his letters to truly understand what he was talking about and why he was so, because he goes to the Andes and he climbs the mountains there, and that's really where he has this epiphany about nature as a unified whole. And I needed to be on these mountains to see what he was seeing. And it was fun.
Yeah, and it was fun. Yeah, it's not bad seeing the Venezuelan rainforest and a volcano. Let's back up to his family life. He was born in 1769 into this wealthy family. They had a winter home and a summer estate, and the name was well respected, the family name. But his father dies when he's quite young, and he had a not so great relationship. He and his brother Wilhelm had a not so great relationship with their mother. She wasn't terribly, she gave them a great education, but she wasn't terribly warm, I guess.
Yeah, so they really got the best education there was in Prussia. But she was very emotionally cold, and she envisaged the future of her sons as being civil servants in the Prussian administration. Now, that was not something that Alexander von Humboldt really wanted to do. He was very much, even as a little boy, he was very much prone to be outside. He wanted to be outside. He escaped the classroom whenever he could. He was not having his nose in books all the time. He wanted to be out amongst trees and plants. He collected constantly as a little boy. He read travel accounts of great explorers such as James Cook, and he was dreaming of this world beyond Prussia. But she was not having any of that, and both sons were kind of good sons in that respect. So the compromise was that he agreed to be a mining inspector in Prussia, because that was as close as he could get to being a scientist and being in nature, because mining was all about geology. But then she died when he was in his mid-20s, and both brothers didn't go to her funeral.
Right.
There's actually a letter written by a friend to Alexander von Humboldt saying, "Oh, you must be so delighted that your mother is finally dead." So he was quite pleased that she was dead, because suddenly he was really wealthy because he inherited a lot of money, and he could go on his voyage. And within 4 weeks of her death, he was planning his voyage. He was zigzagging Europe to buy the best instruments, to meet all the different scientists, to learn as much as possible. So her death absolutely liberated him.
You know, one thing you write about, there are various friendships that he has throughout his life with men, some of them kind of intense, and we don't get a good sense of what those were about. You have a sense that he may have been gay. And therefore, given the confines of society at the time, he must have been a fairly, I don't know what, lonely man as well.
Yes, he had moments of great, great loneliness and solitude, and always said that he found it soothing to be in nature. And he often wrote, "I don't know any sensual needs. You know, I need to climb mountains. That suppresses my passion." So I think we will never quite know if he was gay or not. I'm pretty sure he was.
Yeah.
There are very intense relationships with often younger scientists. I found quite a few letters where others comment on him. So, for example, he strikes up this friendship with a young Ecuadorian scientist, and someone else writes, "Oh, he's now Humboldt's new Adonis." His brother Wilhelm writes to his wife Caroline that he was he says that, you know how he always falls for another man. And then when Humboldt comes to visit Wilhelm once with one of those friends, Wilhelm refuses to have them live with him together. So Humboldt and his friend just, you know, go and stay in a tavern. This is in London. So there are these rumors. There are people talking about it. So he probably was, but we will never really know. I mean, I didn't find a letter where he says, like, oh, last night was just so wonderful. Mm-hmm. So we don't know, basically. Yeah. But I'm pretty sure. But I'm not sure if he ever consummated these loves. What I do know is that he never married. He never had children. There were never people who claimed to be his children. And quite frankly, he didn't really have much time to have a family, I think.
He didn't have time for much. I mean, his life is extraordinary. It's interesting when you, early on in his life, he became obsessed with what they called at the time animal electricity or galvanism. And he does this experiment with Goethe. He strikes up this relationship with the great German poet Goethe, and where he manages to get a frog's leg to twitch. He called it one of the most magical experiments he had ever done. What was this animal electricity part of his early life about?
Well, it was something a lot of scientists were looking into. He's not the only one who's doing that. It was very much at that time, scientists were starting to think about something they called vital forces. So they were interested in matter. They were interested in finding out, was there intrinsically a life, a force, a vital force in matter? Because before you had the French philosopher Descartes, who basically described had a kind of mechanistic view of the world. Animals were described as machines. So there's this shift in the 18th century towards finding out what's happening with inorganic and organic matter. And one of the ways of doing that was looking into animal electricity. And what they did is they basically took parts of animals, like a frog leg, for example, and they poked it with metals and electrodes and chemicals to see if it was twitching. Mm-hmm. And when it was twitching, they concluded that there is like an intrinsic life in there. And Humboldt was very interested in that. And he later, I mean, he's wrong with his theories on animal electricity, but he later transports this concept really onto Earth, to see Earth as a living organism. But in order to find all this out, he uses his own body also. For example, he puts all these kind of electrodes in his own body. He is, later when he's in Latin America, he hears in the Llanos in Venezuela, he hears from the locals that there are electric eels in one of the ponds. Now, electric eels were these huge 5-meter fish, which could discharge a voltage of 600. So highly dangerous. Of course, if you would touch one, you'd be dead immediately. But he was fascinated by it. So, you know, the question was like, how to get them out of the pond? Because they lived kind of buried in the mud at the bottom of the pond. So what they did is they drove 30 wild horses into the pond. The churning hooves of the horses then, you know, got the eels kind of all awakened. And the eels then discharged their electric shocks onto the horses, and by that exhausted themselves. That was then the time to pick them up. But because Humboldt was a very impatient man, he picked them up a little bit too early. So they did all these experiments, and he writes in his diary kind of something like, you know, we were rather exhausted at the end because they got some electric shocks, not 600 ones, but smaller ones. So he's not a cerebral scholar at all. He very much uses his experience with his body, with his senses to understand nature.
This was a theme in his life. He pushed his body to the limits time and time again. And I got a sense he didn't really sleep much. He seemed like he was always moving.
Yeah, he is the most restless man I've ever encountered in history, I have to say. He himself describes that he felt as if he was chased by 10,000 pigs. And that's something that continues all through his life. Mm-hmm. He is there are a lot of people who describe him as talking endlessly, talking very, very fast. Someone describes him as a comet who swishes through the room. Someone else says he's like an overcharged instrument that never stops playing. And he sleeps very little, and he can sustain this work pace by sleeping very little and by drinking a lot of coffee, he says, which he calls concentrated sunshine, which I think is such a nice image. He has a parrot, and the parrot says always, more coffee, more sugar, which must have been Humboldt's most common instruction to his servant, because that's the thing that the parrot repeated again and again and again.
Did he have a photographic memory? I mean, his memory must have been amazing.
Yeah, there are quite a few people who comment on his memory. So I think he was really a little bit, you know, he was a bit of a genius. And he had a memory that was so unusual that people said he could remember, say, the shape of a leaf 40 years later, the strata of rocks, you know, decades later. So what he could do is, as he traveled across the world, he would see things and he would be reminded of things he had seen much earlier. And this is how he understands vegetation zones, because he climbs, for example, the mountains in the Andes, and he sees at different altitudes, he sees plants he has seen elsewhere, say, for example, in the Alps in Switzerland, in the Pyrenees in Spain, and he makes this connection and says, oh, well, these are very similar, but they're across continents. Why is this? So he looks at climate, at altitude, and then concludes that there are these corresponding vegetation zones across the globe.
You mentioned that von Humboldt is turning away from this human-centered perspective that had ruled the day, really, for thousands of years. Aristotle, you mentioned, believed nature has made things for the sake of man, and Francis Bacon believed the world is made for man, and Descartes, as you said, humans are the lords and the possessors of nature. He turns away from that. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that, because you say the perfectibility of nature was dominating Western thinking, and this caught my eye. You write that in some North American thinkers even argued the climate had changed for the better since the settlers arrived and started cutting down all the forests. So would you talk a little bit about that? That was really interesting.
Well, so at that time, in the 18th century, the epitome of beauty were neat fields, for example, or, you know, perfect lines in an orchard. The forest, the untamed forest, was very much seen as a hostile environment, as an obstacle to settlement. So mankind, they believed, was improving on nature. So if you felled trees and you put instead of the forest, you had a field, you were improving on nature. And then a little later, basically what happens that there were arguments, especially in North America, where they said, well, if we get rid of the forests, the air gets better, the climate gets better. So Humboldt comes along and he basically throws this all out of the window, because he travels through South America. And what he sees in South America is how colonialism destroyed the environment. He saw cash crops, monoculture everywhere, and began to understand how the forest functioned for the ecosystem and the climate. So he's the very first to describe the fundamental functions of the forest for the ecosystem, because he said that he talked about the tree's ability to store water, their ability to enrich the atmosphere with moisture, how they protected against soil erosion, the cooling effect of forests. It's just incredible when you think that he talked about this in 1800. And then he makes that leap to think forward. And he says, if we continue like this, the consequences will be catastrophic for the environment. So he talks about mankind's mischief. He talks about unhinging the balance of nature. And a little later in the 1830s, he says there are three ways how humankind affects the environment and the climate: through deforestation, through irrigation, and through the masses of gas in the industrial centers, which is just unbelievable. And then he he basically warns of harmful human-induced climate change more than 200 years ago.
I mean, if you put that in context, I mean, this was so well before anyone was thinking in those terms. I mean, that was, I guess that's the sort of revolutionary nature of his insights, that he had them so early, really before anyone could confirm any of these ideals. He was really working this through.
Yes, he is really, I sometimes describe him as like nature's prophet. I mean, he has such a vision. I suppose the only trouble is because he dabbles in so many different disciplines that he never just focuses on that. So it's just part of his overall view of nature. But he doesn't have a declaration and fights all his life for this. It's just, these are kind of nuggets within the rest of his writing. And then it's basically the people who come after him, who he influences, who take that and who take it further. People like George Perkins Marsh or John Muir, who are both very much influenced by him, Humboldt.
Yeah, it's that imagination thing. It seems like, I mean, he said it's beyond just taking measurements and analysis. You've got to infuse imagination into the process. That was another important way he thought about all of this, it seems.
Yeah, he brings together the arts and the sciences, and I think we have them far too separate at the moment. And he truly is an interdisciplinary man. Who would not separate poetry from science. So, for example, he writes a book called Cosmos, which is his most famous book. It makes him absolutely famous in America, for example. It's a bestseller, gets translated into a dozen languages. And in Cosmos, in the second volume, he writes about landscape painting, he writes about poetry, but this is a book about the universe. So he insists that all of this belongs to the universe, to nature. Everything belongs together. The way we think about nature, the way we write poems about nature, the way we paint nature, all this is part of our understanding of nature.
Andrea Wolf is with us. Her book is The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. We need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Andrea Wolf. We're talking about her new book, The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. She's joining us from the studios of the BBC in London. It was in Latin America where Humboldt has his first encounter with the slave market. He's disgusted by it. He's horrified by it, really. And it made him a lifelong abolitionist. This was something that it seems like a theme for him in his life, and he seemed to make these connections between these bigger ideas about nature, for example, and the ideas of colonialism and freedom. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, he talks, for example, about I think he's the first to make this connection between colonialism and environmental devastation, because he says through slavery, through cash crops, you create a system of injustice and dependency, but you also destroy the environment. So everything for him is connected. He, for example, visits quite a lot of mining towns, mines. He sees how badly the laborers, the indigenous people, are treated there. He then says, well, mining creates this system of injustice. People are in complete dependency, and it destroys the environment. He sees the same with the sugar plantations in Cuba. So he comes away from Latin America being a lifelong abolitionist, and he continues for the rest of his life to write books about this, to criticize it. The Spanish king, for example, who gave him permission to travel to the Spanish colonies, then has to read in one of his books, a scathing attack on Spanish colonialism. And it's something he talks about a lot with North Americans, because he's a great, great, great supporter and fan of the American Revolution. He adores America. He sometimes calls himself, I am half American. But he has a huge problem with slavery in America. And whenever people visit him in Paris and later in Berlin, where he lives, he will always ask them about it. He writes articles in North American newspapers saying this has to stop. So he's very passionate about that. And he praises, for example, in one of his books, he praises Simon Bolivar when Bolivar stopped slavery in Bolivia. So he's very much interested in politics. So he's not just a scientist who's interested in, picking up a few plants. He sees everything, that everything hangs together.
Here's something you quote him comparing the United States to: a Cartesian vortex carrying away and leveling everything to dull monotony. Which is great.
To put that in.
You did. I mean, it's extraordinary. I wonder, Thomas Jefferson thought a lot, as did a lot of, I think, the framers of the Constitution, for example, of von Humboldt's work. They had to avoid the subject of slavery. But what were the conversations like? I mean, he did come here. He did talk to Jefferson.
When he leaves Latin America in 1804, he decides to go back to Europe, but then decides to do a little detour because he wanted to meet the president of the United States. What else do you do?
Right.
So he arrives in North America, and he writes a letter to Jefferson saying, I've just been in Latin America, I've been to Mexico, I've seen all this, I found all this. And Jefferson immediately invites him to Washington for two reasons. One is that Jefferson, of course, himself is a polymath. He's deeply interested in the sciences and in nature. But the timing of Humboldt's visit was absolutely perfect because Jefferson had just bought the Louisiana Territory in the previous year. So there this Prussian explorer arrives who's just spent a year in Mexico and a lot of the time in the archives in Mexico, providing Jefferson with so much information about their new neighbor, Mexico. And Humboldt, who believed in the free exchange of knowledge and that the sciences are not bound by politics, very happily opened his notebooks and his maps and briefed the president of the United States on Mexico.
I want to ask you about Humboldt's relationship with Darwin. So Humboldt writes this 34-volume work, and in it, part of it was this personal narrative about his journeys, about his travels. And Darwin was so taken by it, he actually took this book with him, or wanted to take this book with him, on the Beagle. Would you talk a little bit about what was Darwin? How do you describe Darwin's relationship with Humboldt?
Well, Darwin was much younger.
Yeah.
He's 40 years younger than Humboldt. So Darwin, as a young man, reads Humboldt's personal narrative, which is this part travel account, part scientific treatise of his explorations, and is so fascinated by it that he says that reading personal narrative made him go on the Beagle. So Humboldt is unbelievably influential on Darwin. And not only that, not only does he, inspire him to go on the Beagle, while he's on the Beagle, he has Humboldt's books with him on a shelf next to his hammock. And amazingly, these books still exist in an archive in Cambridge. And when you read them, you see that Darwin heavily annotated them. And it's almost like reading Darwin having a dialogue with Humboldt, because Humboldt influenced him in many different ways. So, for example, when Darwin arrives for the first time in South America, he arrives in Brazil, and it's almost as if he can only understand this new world through the lens of Humboldt's writing. So he says, at the moment, I'm only fit to read Humboldt. And then he uses personal narrative as a model for his own travel account, The Voyage of the Beagle. In style, they're very, very similar because Darwin uses a similar style of combining poetic descriptions with scientific observations. He also uses Humboldt's books when he's working on his theory of evolution to find examples in his books. So Humboldt is this almost, I would say, almost reaches these kind of mythical proportions in Darwin's head. He's his hero. And then there's this almost tragic moment where they actually meet in 1842, which is after the Beagle voyage. And Darwin is so excited to meet Humboldt. And they meet in London, and Humboldt walks into the room, and he's 72, and very much used to being the center of attention. Everybody listens when Humboldt comes into a room. He's the most famous scientist of his age by that time. And Humboldt just talks for 3 hours without stopping. And Darwin does not get a single word in. And he writes to a friend afterwards. He's like, he was just chattering beyond all reason. And if you think about that, what Darwin is doing in 1842, he's in his head, most of his theory on evolution is kind of formed in his head. So he's very much there. Humboldt is writing the first volume of his book, Cosmos, which also describes nature very much in flux. He talks about the transmutation of species there. And you think, if those two men at that time had actually talked to each other, what an amazing moment that would have been. But they didn't, because Humboldt was just talking and didn't let Darwin say anything.
he couldn't shut up. Yeah. It's interesting, in his last days, Humboldt, the thousands and thousands of letters he was receiving, but also writing. And I imagine you've gone through your share of them. He couldn't keep up.
He has the worst handwriting on the planet.
I love that part where they were trying to sort of decipher. You'd have to sort of hand it off to different people to, and maybe even take it. They were taking like a magnifying glass to get a sense of what he was saying.
He has a I think because he has this kind of constant urge to talk and write and share. So he when you look at his letters, first of all, he writes them on his knee, so they're always slanted. And then he runs out of space, and then he has like a little corner free, and he kind of scribbles something in there. And he writes, like, it's very small handwriting, and very bad handwriting. So they literally, people were like passing the letters to the next person. Like, can you decipher this word? Can you decipher this word? And then it gets worse, really, because when I looked at his manuscripts, especially his lecture notes, for example, you really see how his mind works, because they are... He starts fairly conventional enough, like on a piece of paper, and then he has some thoughts and he kind of scribbles them in a corner, and then he has more thoughts and he's run out of paper, so he tears out another bit of paper and he sticks them with like little, it's like little glue bits, sticks them on top of each other, and then he reads something in a book and he tears out that page and he sticks it on there. So you end up with this multi-layered collage of thoughts, and it only really, I mean, there's no apparent order. How on earth he did a lecture with this, I have absolutely no idea. But you can see that his mind worked not in a linear way, but in a web-like way. And this is really also how he understands nature. And I think the way he thinks, that's how he then understood nature.
Andrea Wolf, her book is The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. And we need to take another quick break. But we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Andrea Wolf. We're talking about her book, The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. There's kind of a coda for the book, Humboldt and his influence on particular scientists. The last chapters are about Humboldt and George Perkins Marsh and Ernest Haeckel and John Muir. And I wanted to talk about some of these because they represent these three different areas that Humboldt impacted. There's that relationship between man and nature and art and nature and then, of course, preservation. Let's start with George Perkins Marsh, a remarkable man. And I guess in some ways, and maybe this is true of Muir and Haeckel too, similar kind of background, precocious and ravenous for information, desperate to travel the world. Talk about his relationship, George Perkins Marsh's relationship with Humboldt.
So George Perkins Marsh actually never met Humboldt.
Yeah.
He is from Vermont, and he also becomes an ambassador for America. So he's first in Turkey, and then he's later the ambassador in Italy. But he very much he's a linguist. He speaks 20 languages fluently, and he loves German books, and he's very well read. He has about 5,000 books in his library, and a lot of them are German. And he reads Humboldt's books, and when he travels to the Old World, to Turkey, and then he also travels to the Far East, and he travels through Europe. He sees it really almost through the eyes of Humboldt's writing, and he sees how 2,000 years of agriculture have pretty much destroyed large parts of the Old World. So he sees the barren hills, he sees what irrigation is doing, and he returns to America after his first visit in Europe, and he looks at the American landscape differently. He looks through it through the prism of what he has seen in Europe, and he says, well, if we continue like this here in America, the New World is going to look as devastated as the Old World, so we have to do something. And he writes a book which is called Man and Nature, which is published in 1864, which I think is one of the most important environmental books ever published in America. And it's a warning. It's a very stark warning. I mean, he's not beating around the bush at all. He very much says, if we continue like this, we are dismantling this earth. We are going to turn this planet, we're going to ravage this, we're going to turn it barren. And he quotes Humboldt. He's very much influenced by this idea that nature is this kind of interconnected whole, and describes how, for example, there's a fascinating example where he says how the changing fashion in hats in Paris has an influence on the beaver population in Canada, because fur hats go out of fashion in Paris. So the beaver population can recover in Canada. I mean, it's just such a leap of connection he makes there. And that's very much a kind of Humboldtian way of thinking.
Marsh wanted to call his book Man and Nature. His original title was Man, the Disturber of Nature's Harmonies. The publisher
did not like that.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about Humboldt's influence on Ernest Haeckel. Again, like Marsh, Haeckel was powerfully influenced by Humboldt's books. He also longed to travel the world. You want to say something about this relationship?
Yeah, so Haeckel is a German zoologist, and he is born in 1834, so he's much, much younger than Humboldt. But he's brought up with Humboldt's books. A lot of these men are also brought up with Humboldt's travel accounts. So this is why a lot of them also want to travel. So they want to see the world out there. So Haeckel reads these books. He absolutely adores Humboldt. When he's a student in Germany, he has a Humboldt portrait in his room. And then he studies zoology, and he becomes fascinated with these tiny little one-celled marine organisms called Radiolarian. And they're tiny. You can only see them under a microscope. But they're beautifully symmetrical. So he begins to draw them. And he's incredibly talented. He can look with one eye into the microscope and with the other eye on the piece of paper. So he and they're absolutely beautiful, these drawings he does. And what he does is, and he says, I am combining art and science. I'm following Humboldt. At some stage, he wanted to be a landscape painter, but his parents didn't really want that. So he brings art into science. And then the extraordinary thing happens. His drawings are so stunningly beautiful that a lot of the Art Nouveau architects and designers and artists use them as an inspiration. So if you look at Art Nouveau furniture, you will often see kind of these kind of floral-like and very sinuous kind of forms. And a lot of it comes from Haeckel's drawing. So in a way, you could almost argue, but that's pushing it a little bit, I think, but you could almost argue that Humboldt even had an impact on Art Nouveau.
Yeah. Haeckel called it a natural religion. And I guess this is the transition that's happening around this time, I suppose, this and with Darwin as well, replacing the idea of God with a natural process, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it's when you look at, for example, Haeckel, Humboldt, and Muir, what is quite interesting to see is how they interpret this web of life very differently. So Humboldt, for example, kind of avoids the topic. So he writes a 5-volume book, Cosmos, about the universe without ever mentioning the word God.
Right.
So he's not mentioning it at all. Then you have someone like Haeckel, who's a monoist, so he really believes that everything is one, truly one. There is not kind of a divine sphere in a natural world. And then you have Muir, on the other hand, who's very much influenced by Humboldt's ideas of nature as an interconnected whole and his ideas on preservation and deforestation. And also this sense of wonder. I mean, Muir is so much driven by this sense of wonder, by his love for nature. But at the same time, Muir very much sees the divine in nature.
Yeah. It's so interesting the way I hadn't realized the influence of Humboldt on John Muir. Because go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, he actually, as a young man, says how intensely I desire to be a Humboldt.
Yeah.
And it is Humboldt, because he reads Humboldt's books, he wants to go to South America and then kind of gets stuck in Florida with malaria and then decides to go to California. But he reads Humboldt's books, he's very much influenced. And again, Muir's books on Humboldt also still exist in an archive in Stockton, California. And again, he heavily annotates them. And you can see that he underlines everything that Humboldt writes about deforestation, for example, the devastating effect of deforestation, Muir underlines. And Muir's very famous quote about everything is hitched to the universe, that is very much a kind of Humboldtian idea.
Muir was convinced, it seems like Humboldt was, that if you wanted to understand nature, that your feelings, your emotions were as important as scientific data. Is that where he must have gotten that directly from Humboldt?
Yeah, I mean, it's very much something where when you read both of them, you see so many similarities. And in a way, I think it's Muir who takes the baton of nature writing from Humboldt and kind of really brings it to another level. I mean, Muir so much kind of pulls his reader into nature and kind of takes them up mountains and across meadows and below waterfalls. And it's very much what he read in Humboldt's books, but he does it even stronger, even more lively, it's kind of almost visceral what Muir does.
You know, of course, it leaves us with that big question of why is it that we remember Darwin and why don't we remember Humboldt? And there are complicated reasons for that, I guess.
Yeah, and I think we will never quite know precisely why, but I think that it's a bunch of reasons. One is that Humboldt never comes up with a theory like Darwin. Darwin comes up with his theory of evolution. Humboldt comes up with a view of the world, a holistic view of the world. There's really no one discovery kind of attached to Humboldt's name. That's one reason. And I think the other reason is that he's the last of the polymaths. He dies in 1859, which is just a few months before The Origin of Species is published. And it's very much the last moment, I think, where one person can hold all the knowledge of the world in their head. And after that, the sciences specialize. The scientists kind of crawl into their narrowing disciplines. They become experts, and they begin to look down on people like Humboldt, who are not experts, who are generalists. So that's one reason. The other reason might be that Humboldt's ideas have become so self-evident that we've almost forgotten the man behind him. And that might be one of the main reasons why he's so forgotten in the English-speaking world, is that he was famous until World War I. And then with, anti-German sentiment, that was really not a time anymore to celebrate a German scientist. So I think it's several reasons. But saying all that, I think the time is ripe to, you know, remember him again, because he's so modern in his approach. And just from the reactions I'm getting when I talk about him to people, people are just amazed about him, because he was so forward-thinking and so modern, and he seems so much part of our thinking today in a way. We might have forgotten about him, but I think we should reclaim him as our hero, especially for the environmental movement, because the environmental movement doesn't really have this kind of long history and a kind of a hero they can kind of look back to.
No, I mean, when you think about the challenge of climate change, I mean, you point out in your book, you know, Humboldt's approach, if you think about it, is more relevant than ever. I mean, we're talking about how good Humboldt was at being accessible in his writing and how he fostered communication across disciplines. I mean, those are all really good examples for modern
thinkers. Very,
very
relevant today. Very relevant today, I think. You know, where, you know, climate change can only be tackled if, you know, lots of people come together, lots of disciplines come together. This is something that Humboldt was preaching many, many years ago. And I was thinking about that when I was listening to all the reports about the Paris Climate Summit. Humboldt organizes a congress for scientists in the 1820s in Berlin, and he says, "Well, I'm basically fed up that people come, 500 scientists, and one scientist reads a paper to all of them, and everybody just listens and falls asleep." So what he's doing is he's putting them together in small groups. He is arranging all these like social outings, and he's putting scientists together from different disciplines, because he believes that you should foster the communication across disciplines. And he also believes that people need to be together also on a social level to then start really talking and learning from each other.
Andrea Wolf, her book, The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. She joined us from the studios of the BBC in London. Andrea Wolf, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.